Hello, and welcome to the No Good Poetry Podcast. Each week we talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly of poetry.
This is episode 9.
With
Joseph Bienvenu and
Joseph Makos.
This is the good, bad, and the ugly, isn't it? Some ugly shit out there, kids. Let's make the world safer for poetry.
So this week, we're going to do something a little bit different.
And we're going to feature some book releases that are coming up for three lady poets.
Lady poets? I don't like.
You don't like the term? Okay, three poets.
If you want to emphasize that, you need to say three female poets or three women poets, but don't say lady. That sounds like...
All right. That sounds like what?
You're the Beastie Boys or something. Hey, lady.
We're not trying to be the BC Boys.
Yes, three female poets. And I think one thing we like to do on this podcast is hopefully expose you to some things you might not know about. And these are all poets that we know because of their presence in New Orleans and having read here many times. But we think they're doing interesting work, and we want you to decide what you think of them.
Indeed. And we'll have them on each talking about their up-and-coming releases and reading a few poems from the book.
Absolutely.
So, all right, should be good.
Here's our first interview. So I'm here today with poet Gina Ferreira to talk about her book that just recently came out, Fitting the Sixth Finger. And this is an ekphrastic group of poems, right?
Yeah, basically all of the poems in the collection were inspired by Marc Chagall paintings. And while they don't always specifically reference one particular Chagall painting, some of them do and some of them don't. So I guess they're kind of loosely ekphrastic, yeah.
So some of them actually are, and some of it's just the general...
kind of feeling of Chagall, right.
So why Chagall? What led you to writing poems?
Actually, a book. I started writing these poems, I want to say, in 2008. I was working on my preface for my thesis, and I was also teaching middle school at the time, so I was really exhausted. I had given Jonathan a book about Marc Chagall, and so late at night, I would just kind of leaf through this book, and I began writing poems. And so I started that in maybe 2008. Some of the poems, the early versions of them, came out in Ethereal Avalanche, which was a book that was put out by Trembling Pillow Press. Mm-hmm. And then kind of I had another book that came out in 2012, 2013 called Amber Porchlight. And the poems in that book were very, very different than the Chagall poems. But I started to kind of look at those Chagall poems again, look at the paintings, and then probably in 2013, I started writing more Chagalls, or more Chagall-inspired poems. Then kind of probably finished up that manuscript maybe in 2014, 15. So this is kind of what's kind of come about as a result of all of that. Well, I don't know. I'll start reading. Before the poem took form. I never wrote of candy luminous skies, entendres of violets and greens, the edible things adrift spun from air. Though I saw the pink clouds, their sweet sachets and segues, solidity nearly reached. How they tinged the background exactly in a shade of fluster or mild embarrassment, a silent but delicate rush of blood beneath the skin. One evening, minutes before dusk encroached, I reclined in a grazing field, my sweat touching soft blades. The mare and newly fleeced ewe chewed the earth, the verdant continuation before the poem took form. between blunt blade and handle. It began in pencil, the point defining as my mania grew sleepless in the heat, no time to erase rapid strokes on paper. The wound sprawled, a dripping sun above the wheat field, a virgin bullseye, center intact as a perfect red pupil. I saw in a field of fire the distance between blunt blade and handle, a saffron sky framed by the scythe you once held, blade glinting with the sheen of a wish.
What is it about Chagall that appeals to you in particular as a painter?
I think Chagall...
Or is it just happenstance? I don't know.
No, probably a little bit of both. But that book happened to be just around when I needed some kind of break from what I was doing. But kind of in looking at those paintings, Chagall has things happening on his canvas that I think should actually happen in a poem, where anything is really possible. Kind of within a context of looking at his origins, looking at the village where he was born, or looking at his life in Paris, looking at his life with his wife, Bella, And so there's a narrative in those works. There's also a lot of symbolism, a lot of metaphor, a lot of color, and obviously a lot of imagery. And so to me, kind of what Chagall is doing in those paintings are really kind of the things that I like to see happen in poetry.
So that combination of all those different ways of working is kind of neat. Yeah, he does have that narrative aspect to his paintings that is pretty neat. The last two times I was in Chicago and I was at the Art Institute, there's this one painting of his in particular that I just keep going back and looking at, The Birth. And it's this woman in the village giving birth. I don't know if it's supposed to be something more specifically tied to his life or not, which is already an interesting topic for a painting.
Then
there's all these different people. I mean, you could spend, it's one of his larger ones, and you could spend so much time because there's all these different people in the background doing different things that all kind of have their own mini narratives going
That's right. So he really kind of has a way of kind of presenting kind of his just different things like the painting that you're referencing, The Birth. It really looks at his life in his village, which is, I think it's Vitebsk. I'm not sure how to pronounce it in Russian, but that's where he lived, and then he moved eventually to St. Petersburg. He lived there for a while, and then he moved to Paris. And then when World War II started, he moved with his family here to New York. But I just really, really love the subject of his paintings and kind of what he's doing in those paintings. And I think that there's something about those paintings that, people just really can identify with them, even though they're strange and an animal might appear in the middle of nowhere kind of thing. But if you look at them, there's always something to find in those paintings, which is really neat.
Well, there's something kind of like folktale-ish almost about it.
Oh, yeah.
Where, it's kind of a mundane world in some ways, but then these kind of magical things can just sort of happen out of nowhere.
I mean, kind of almost magical realism, if you will, but I guess that's kind of a different subject for a different time. I just find that his work, kind of the composition of his work is very poetic. And to me, that what he's doing, it's what a poem or really what art should do. I mean, it just kind of explodes. His compositions just sort of explode with possibility. And I really, really like that dynamic in work.
So you said these poems are very different than poems in your last book. How is them being a response to the Chagall? How is that kind of shaped by that?
Well, I think, I know I have a tendency to really write narrative poems. in some ways, it was really a relief these poems were to kind of get away from myself and to really kind of look at something that was almost, for me, it was almost like a clean slate. It didn't have any kind of emotional, an emotional attachment to it that a lot of narrative poems do. So these, I feel like they were almost borrowed narratives. And they were, like, somebody who read the book said, "Wow, you seem really happy." And I think that's because, well, most of the subjects of Chagall's work, I think it's happy often. But then the other thing about that was that it wasn't like my own personal narrative, which was a nice break for a change.
So what is the significance of the title, Fitting the Sixth Finger?
If you look at a lot of Chagall's self-portraits, he often presents himself with having maybe a hand with six fingers, mm-hmm. seven fingers, eight fingers. And I just kind of like that idea of kind of an extra finger on the hand. You know, like, is that an oddity or is it a blessing? Or, you know, I think the sixth finger, you can kind of read that both ways. You know, that it could be kind of an interesting thing, but it could be a curse to have an extra finger, too.
Oh, yeah, that could be its own narrative in itself.
Yeah.
How does extra fingers get there?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So
when you decided that you needed to have a collection that was all of these together, did that change how you thought about it as you were trying to think about how to organize them or how to put them together?
Well, I always, like, struggle with organization, you know, of how to, like, kind of organize poems. And so that's not something that is inherent in me to kind of organize them. But I just started kind of writing these until I felt like, I mean, for me, what was a really good thing was the fact that, you know, Chagall lived to be like maybe 97 or 98 years old. So he has this vast body of work.
Yeah.
So there was kind of a lot to choose from. And I kind of felt like I wanted to kind of to try and write 50 to 60 poems. And that's kind of what I did.
Well, that's great. Now we're going to cut away here for the listeners so they can hear you read some of the poems from your book. But I also wanted to mention, I think you have a reading coming up. You want to say a little bit about that and let people know?
Yeah, the reading, I had a reading at Octavia a couple of weeks ago, and I'm going to have another reading at the Maple Leaf on Sunday the 28th, 3:30. And then I'm not sure about this, but I'm trying to get a reading at maybe a gallery in the Bywater, and I'm still trying to work that out. So I guess that's to be determined.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you. Hemorrhage. By needle, nail, or blade, blood arrives as one bubbling droplet, the red unabashed bead when the skin breaks. But what about the brush, quicksilver with its dipped bristles, stroking the taut white expanse, until that hemorrhage of blue, the dark rush of it forms last night's Parisian sky. The roof grows red. A bow moves in the space between narrow longitudes and what's eternally parallel. With his only follower, the fiddler has one eye open and the other closed to the world's apparitions and horizons. He gets by with his half vision, his unfinished sentences, and not knowing who won the war or which son was born. Paying visual homage. To paint a mood, an innate feeling, a sudden flash of intuition rather than a time marked by war or inventions means removing the black glove, the solitary one worn during the heist. No faces will stand out in the deep scope of this blue, bluer than delphiniums or hyacinths, more tranquil than sorrowful. One temple is any temple. The houses of this moment are melodious as a nocturne, rising and falling along my road that celebrates the avoidance of anything rendered linear. Before occupying center ring. Pliable as lemon taffy in whims, I contort, ecstatic, on a horse's back, limber on one foot. I raise my leg in arabesque, stretch it toward the fullest moon like my last exaggeration. Before the swell, the calliope's call, I study the acrobat unbound, who swings over the bar. The sinewy back, the taut torso, moves in clockwise and counterclockwise hours. Corner to corner, jacquard trapezoids of touching colors above an audible sea of sudden gasps.
Okay, here we are for our second interview of the day with a poet who has once lived here, does not live here now, lives in California, but is deeply inspired by her experiences in New Orleans. I believe that is accurate. Krista Sanders, thanks for coming by. No Good Poetry Podcast.
Thank you both for having me. This is exciting.
So we're going to talk a little bit about Country, out soon next week on Trembling Pillow.
Yeah, I think the official date that is out is June 11th, when we're having a book launch at Antenna Gallery.
Oh, fantastic.
Great. Yeah.
Just our neighbors, a few blocks away.
Yeah.
All right, great. You know, do you want to read something? Do you want to, and then bring us into it? Can you do a little invocation here? Read something?
Read something first?
Yeah, why not? And then read something.
Okay, all right. So, I was thinking about this. When I read in real life, I usually sing a little bit of the epigraph of the country songs, but it makes me much more nervous than, like, doing it in,
we'll close our eyes.
In a small crowd.
We can all close our eyes.
Okay.
You can have
the
room.
Okay. The country song is called Chattahoochee, sung by Alan Jackson. And it's so, it's a 90s country song, and in case you can't remember, I can jog your memory. It goes, way down yonder on the Chattahoochee, never knew how much that muddy water meant to me, but I learned how to swim, and I learned who I was, a lot about living and a little about love. Okay. Country music is the river I rode. I bathed in its beer and semen shores, met the female objects of my dreams. Licked mud from the soles of their feet, my tongue the fish between their toes. I swallowed, made them shine. They led me to my manhood, then I became a woman, then a dim body in a bed, then again a girl. When country music was done with me, I was limping naked in the woods, a tattoo of a heart where my heart should have been. And now here I am, shimmering in the ugly trespass. Yeah.
So I guess you kind of, in the poem that you read, it kind of gave us an indication. But how does that all fit in with your book here?
Okay. So I was really influenced by 80s and 90s country songs. And my uncle is a country songwriter in Nashville. He's in the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame. He wrote a lot of the 90s hits. And then his biggest hit was I Hope You Dance. Remember that one?
I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, it was like a crossover hit. He won a Grammy for Country Song of the Year. So I always kind of wanted to be a country songwriter, and then I wrote poetry instead. And in 2013, I did go to Nashville and I tried to be a country songwriter. But I realized that there's a lot that you can't say in a country song. And that felt really limiting. It was really collaborative. You write in groups of two or three. It was very formulaic. And it made me just sort of angry. And I wanted to say all the words that I couldn't say in a country song. And all the things that I couldn't say. So I wrote country instead. And I left after a year. And I moved back to New Orleans.
Okay. So this sounds... I like this. Because you're like... Okay, so you go off for this experience to go see what it's like over there.
Yeah.
And it turns out that it's basically just like the MFA program.
Way worse.
I'm kidding. I just figured I'd base it a little bit like that. But it's sort of like this completely, this formulaic.
Yeah.
almost like rhyming poetry, right?
It is rhyming poetry.
Yeah.
That could make you a lot of money. So...
Can't they just plug it all into, can't the, like, machines write it now?
It feels like that. I mean, actually, it was so formulaic, you'd get together with a group of, like, two or three, and you'd say, some people would have their guitars, I was going to be more of a lyricist, so I could play the guitar, but I wasn't really good enough. And you'd be like, what ideas are you thinking about? And somebody would say, like, usually a title idea, and it would be alliterative, and then you would work your way backwards, like, oh, that alliteration sounds great, so what would that song be about? So it really wasn't often coming from a very genuine place.
Well, that's strange, right? Because I think country music kind of has this aura around it. Maybe it's left over from a different time of being more authentic. And
totally, yeah.
Everybody can't be Dwight Yoakam.
Oh, I love Dwight Yoakam.
Right?
Yeah.
Me too.
So, yeah, like, I don't know if he writes his own stuff, though.
I think he does write a lot of his
maybe
own stuff.
Or at least co-writes.
It just seems like he still has the thing, though, that the old school country is still made up of.
Yeah,
he's holding on to this particular crooning country lineage.
I have no idea.
I don't listen to any country. I listen to some recently, like albums all the way through. Like,
that's cool.
Good stuff.
Yeah,
but there's something lost, right? Because is it this pop element that came in?
Sure, totally, yeah.
I saw this YouTube video once it showed like 8 number one country songs.
And they're all the same.
The formulas of the progressions and everything were almost identical in like every part of the way possible.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, actually, I think one time my uncle sued Faith Hill or her writers or something because there was too much of a similarity in one of his Faith Hill hits and then like a second later hit or something. I think it was a big hit. I can't remember the name of the song exactly. But so, I don't know. I mean, I have a lot of respect for early country music, like in the 60s. I think it was way more feminist. Like, who has the song about the pill? I can't remember the name of the singer who has a song about, it's like an ode to the birth control pill.
Really?
Yeah.
Male singer or female singer?
Female singer.
Female singer.
Loretta Lynn, maybe? Oh. I can't remember. Okay. I should know that. And then in the 80s and the 90s, it got way more, I'd say, even more feminist with Shania Twain.
The pill, Loretta Lynn.
Loretta Lynn. Loretta. I knew it. Yeah. So in the 80s and the 90s, the country music was, Shania Twain made it kind of feminist. And there were, there's like Mary Chapin Carpenter and Trisha Yearwood and Reba McEntire and these women who were like middle-aged, not terribly attractive, not super skinny. I mean, of course, Shania Twain was really hot, but the other ones. And they were singing about being a woman and being a wife and being frustrated. And that was great. And then I think it all went downhill after the 90s.
As a genre, it's always kind of had a formulaic aspect to it more than other types of music.
Well, yeah. Pop is kind of formulaic, too. Well,
certainly, yeah.
But somehow manages to be more feminist lately.
Well, yeah, but I guess, well, I mean, and maybe there's a way to work within that formula and still get different kinds of messages across. But I mean, I don't know, I guess I'm just thinking, like, you're talking about the evolution of what happened from the 80s through the 90s and then now.
Yeah.
And it kind of seems like the formula took over more. Like, it was always there. But it was more a bare bones kind of structure where maybe now the formula is more at the forefront.
Yeah, no, that's true. I agree.
Do you think that there's any, I mean, is there any gems? Is there anything coming through, like some?
I don't know. I think that's a good question. And there are certainly people doing interesting things in Nashville and sort of like indie country, I think is cool. Alt country, I guess you could call it. And then there's people like Kacey Musgraves. She's kind of on the radio right now and she has some good hits, good writing. And one of the embarrassing things was that I was a server at a restaurant in East Nashville, and I was 30, and I once served dinner to, like, Kacey Musgraves and some other sort of, like, famous young women who were my same age. One was writing songs for the TV show Nashville, and I was serving them steak and thinking, like, this sucks, because I came here way too late. They've all been at it for 10 years. And they've achieved some success, and that's great. And I'm their same age, but I'm a beginner. I don't know. It was very frustrating.
So that's kind of the situation that led you to write the book, right?
Loosely.
Being able to do the things you couldn't do when you're writing country.
Yeah,
but the
freedom.
But obviously, like, also that situation is feeding into the poems.
Yeah.
What was there, like, a cathartic experience?
Oh, totally. Yeah. And then I also should say that, I mean, it's not really just about country songs. It's also a lot about sex and sexuality and porn. I mean, that's probably more in there
than
country.
I guess we should say
that's probably why it's called country.
Right.
Well, but that's what
like
I'm
country.
I should say this is an audio podcast, so you can't see that it's spelled without the O here.
Right, but you can say whatever you want.
You can. I usually tell people I wrote a book and it's called country, you know, like country. And then they get it.
Well, if they see the book, they did. But
that's true.
So my question is where does this work? Is it tangential from like the reaction to the work that you were going there to do, like to create these country songs? Was it is it sort of like, does it come from the same pool or does it come from a different?
I think it's all wrapped up and came out of the same area, because when I was going to write country songs, I wanted to write feminist country songs, and that was the only thing I wanted to write. I just wanted to write about sexuality and gender and, you know, relationships and things like that. But the experience was very limiting. And so I wrote a lot of these. Some of these poems I had already started working on, and some of them I wrote while I was there in Nashville. And also, so I had been working on this book really since 2012 and reading from it around New Orleans and publishing pieces from it. And then it kind of took shape in the later, you know, in the more recent years. And then so I've been working on it for a long time. And it, to me, it kind of is like a little bit of an angry book and like a little bit also tongue in cheek and has a dark humor that I think comes across more when I'm reading from it at readings than when a person's reading it on their own. But so it sort of encapsulates my 20s, and now I'm 33. So it's, you know, it's like, older sort of like frustrated feelings that I worked through in writing this book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was wondering, you know, could your book country be used as a text to search for potential places to then write the quintessential feminist country album? Can you take this and work from this and actually write your album?
Oh my gosh.
And make your album.
That's crazy. I don't know. I kind of gave up writing songs and singing Because, I don't know. The weird thing about writing songs is that it feels like there's so many boundaries, and I could never, obviously I've said this already, I could never say what I wanted to say, but even just in writing a song, it was like language just escaped me, you know? So I really am not even that interested in that anymore.
We're definitely going to at some point do an episode about writing lyrics and
oh, yeah.
What that's like. I mean,
poets and lyricists.
That's cool.
I love writing song lyrics, but it's such a different thing.
Yeah.
It's so totally different from writing poetry. And I think if you try to approach it in the same way, it's frustrating.
Yeah, totally.
It's not the same at all.
Yeah,
and like you said, there's a lot of constraints. You've got to, when you're writing song lyrics, you really just have to follow the music and where it's going. You can't, it's a whole different thing. The music needs to take the forefront. When you're writing lyrics, it's weird.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and I didn't grow up playing any instruments, so that part was always kind of hard for me. I don't really know how you, say orgasm in a song, you know?
Well, that can be done. But part of the reason we wanted to have you on is so people would learn about your book, and I know you're kind of doing some... Do you have anything coming up where you're doing readings? Because I know you mentioned the antenna.
Yeah, thing. Antenna Gallery. I don't have anything else planned in New Orleans. I'm just here for 3 weeks. And then I'm going back to California.
Did we say that? When is the antenna reading?
June 11th.
Do you want to maybe read us a little more to go out here?
Okay. Maybe I'll read a more pornographic one. Okay, yeah.
All right.
So this is called Internet Porn Country Song. Okay. AOL came in the mail on a disc. 100 hours free trial. The internet arrived. He brought his laptop to you, said, let's look together. So you looked together. You Googled sex. The first thing you searched for was sex. You saw a penis for the first time, gigantic and ruby red in the huge cock way. You were scared. You cybered. I mean, you had cyber sex. You wanted to know the words, didn't you? A penis hammered into a vagina. You should have looked away. You looked together and he touched you. You walked into the boys' dorm room and they were looking at porn. Your roommate walked into your dorm room, and you were looking at porn. You quickly closed the screen, closed the laptop, flipped to another tab. You erased the computer history, but it didn't work. Your parents caught you. Girls Gone Wild played in the background at a party. You couldn't look away. You rubbed against the floor while your roommate wasn't looking. The iPhone arrived. He took photos of you on his iPhone. You walked naked in the forest, and he took photos of you on his iPhone. There were a whole lot of people in the room. You looked together and he touched you, and you had only ever touched yourself. The man wanted to meet you. You weren't alone and you cried. You finished and you cried. You said, please erase those pictures of me. You said, that one's okay. You were afraid. You were no longer afraid. You wanted to know why it was always the looking that did it. You used to be so simple. You used to be so pure. No, when was it ever just you and an open hand? You looked. You looked. Someone asked you if you looked. You said, yes, I do, and I like it.
All right.
Here we go.
Before we totally leave you today, we just wanted to, especially those of you who have listened to several episodes, if you haven't, go back and listen to some of the old episodes as well. It would really help us out if you could go into iTunes and give us a review.
That would be fantastic. All we're asking for is to go through, access your iTunes podcasts, go into the proper system.
Actually, you can make it even easier than that. All you have to do is type in nogoodpoetry.com/iTunes, and it will open your iTunes app for you and take you right to the podcast.
There you go.
All you have to do is click on the review and enter the review. And really, the only reason, the way iTunes works, of course, is, you know, where a podcast gets listed is based on reviews as part of the algorithm, part of, you know, how high up it shows up. And we, you know, it would really help us get more listeners. But...
if you could give us a review. But yeah, tell your friends too if you like the podcast. Let them know. Get some more people listening to it.
All right. Thanks for listening.